Chapter 16. Politics and the Picaresque. If mankind were to resolve to agree in no institution of government until every part of it had been adjusted to the most exact standard of perfection, society would soon become a general scene of anarchy and the world a desert. Alexander Hamilton, Federalist, Number 65. A most unusual book arrived at Mount Vernon in March 1787. It had been published in Philadelphia. Nothing too unusual about that. Philadelphia was the foremost publishing center in 18th century America. Titled The Lyric Works of Horace, it largely consisted of English translations of Horace and other classical poets. That was not so unusual either. American editions of classical texts had appeared sporadically since the Philadelphia printer Samuel Keimer had issued an English translation of Epictetus in the 1720s. According to its title page, the lyric works of Horace had been translated by a native of America. Again, not too unusual. Many contemporary works of poetry appeared anonymously or pseudonymously, and pseudonyms expressing pride in America had become increasingly common during the Revolutionary era. Besides, the author, a Delaware poet named John Park, who had served as a lieutenant colonel in the Continental Army, identified himself in the cover letter he sent with the book, so his authorship was no big secret. What does make this work unusual is the original play Park appended to his Latin translations, Virginia, a Pastoral Drama. In Park's verse drama, rural swains and carefree shepherdesses sing happy songs as they gambol along the shores of the Potomac, celebrating the greatness of the man who lived there, a godlike war hero named Daphnis, which, of course, is a thinly veiled portrait of Washington. One character conveys the sentiments Washington felt since returning to Mount Vernon. Now war's alarms are haply o'er, again we meet to part no more, ne'er to forsake again Potomac's shore. Besides writing a play about him, Park had also dedicated the lyric works of Horace to Washington. Upon receiving the book, Washington wrote to thank this bard of the Brandywine, though he did wish Park had asked permission before dedicating the work to him. Since Park had published the book by subscription, the list of subscribers printed with it includes the names of many of the most prominent men in the nation. Washington often subscribed to books by American authors to encourage the growth of American literature. He was disappointed Park had not asked him to subscribe. His thank you letter gives the impression that he would rather have been a subscriber to this book than the subject of a mawkish pastoral drama elevating him to godlike status. Despite his shortcomings as a dramatist, Park correctly inferred the feelings of contentment Washington experienced upon returning to the life of a gentleman farmer on the Potomac. Unlike Daphnis in the drama, Washington would forsake Potomac's shore to serve his country further. Increasingly divisive conflicts between the states convinced him that more had to be done to safeguard the new nation against internal strife. Though hesitant to get involved in politics again, Washington saw that the United States needed his leadership. Before March gave way to April, he would write to Edmund Randolph, effectively agreeing to attend the Constitutional Convention as a delegate from Virginia. Less than 2 months later, he found himself on the road to Philadelphia. Sunday morning, May 13, 1787, Washington reached Chester, Pennsylvania, where he met up with some old friends, including one of his best, David Humphreys. They traveled together as a group to Philadelphia, arriving later that day. Once they entered the city, Washington went to Franklin Court on Market Street, where he renewed his friendship with Benjamin Franklin, whom he had not seen since 1775, when Franklin had visited the headquarters of the Continental Army in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on behalf of Congress. Franklin had returned home from Paris on the same ship that brought Houdon to America in 1785, but so far Washington had not had the opportunity to see him. From the time Franklin left for Paris in 1776 until his return, he and Washington had exchanged letters sporadically. Their letters mainly concerned the business of the new nation, but both sides of their correspondence express warm personal feelings. In Philadelphia that May, Washington and Franklin were happy to see one another after a lapse of a dozen years. Benjamin Franklin Bache had accompanied his grandfather when he went to Paris in 1776. Only 7 years old then, Benny, as he was known in the family, received an excellent education in Europe, living part of the time at a boarding school in Geneva. He spent his last 2 years in Paris on the outskirts of the city at Passy, where his grandfather taught him the basics of the printing trade at the small press he operated as a hobby. 2 years after they returned to Philadelphia, Franklin established a business for his grandson as printer, publisher, and newspaper editor. Franklin scarcely realized the powerful forces he unleashed when he taught his grandson how to control the printed word and gave him the voice to express himself to the public. Washington scarcely realized that this young printer and newspaper man, this grandson of a dear friend, would become a thorn in his side over the next decade. During Washington's presidency, Bache's newspaper, the Aurora, would be the single most important opposition paper in the nation. During the absence of her father and son, Sarah Bache and her husband Richard had been taking care of Franklin Court. When Benjamin Franklin returned from Paris, he found his house chock full of little Baches. There was scarcely enough room for his ample girth or the thousands of books he brought from Paris. Consequently, he built a new addition to his home. After her father's return, Sarah Bache continued to function as the mistress of Franklin Court, but Benjamin Franklin enjoyed showing off the new wing and its library, which housed the books and curiosities he had spent a lifetime collecting. Franklin took an interest in all fields of science and technology. Displaying his library to visitors, he would choose books from it that suited their tastes and interests. Though he was not a farmer, he had a very good collection of agricultural books. When it came to agricultural libraries, few could surpass the one at Mount Vernon, so Franklin could hardly teach Washington anything new about farming. Still, his collection was impressive, not only for its agricultural books, but also for its overall breadth and depth. With more than 4,000 volumes, all easily locatable due to the ingenious catalog he had devised, Franklin's personal library impressed everyone who visited. Washington's correspondence records one work Franklin showed him. When he and Don Diego de Gardoqui, the Spanish envoy to the United States, happened to visit Franklin Court together, they enjoyed seeing their host's library. Franklin showed them the four-volume edition of Don Quixote, published in Madrid by Joaquin Ibarra. Commissioned by the Real Academia de la Lengua, which oversaw its publication, the edition was absolutely gorgeous. Printed on elegant paper using a new typeface specially designed for it and illustrated with handsome engravings, this edition established Don Quixote as a landmark of Spanish literature. Paradoxically, Don Quixote had been recognized as a great book among English readers before it was accepted as a classic in Spain. The Spanish formerly saw the work as little more than a burlesque of chivalric romance, but the Real Academia edition made Don Quixote a national treasure. Franklin enjoyed showing his copy of the edition to those who visited. When he showed his copy to Washington and Gardoqui, Washington was impressed having never seen this beautifully printed and illustrated edition before. A good diplomat, Gardoqui stored away this piece of information. In an effort to curry Washington's favor, he would subsequently present him with a copy of the Real Academia Don Quixote for his library at Mount Vernon. The Constitutional Convention was scheduled to begin on Monday, May 14th. Though the delegates from Pennsylvania and Virginia had reached Philadelphia in time, representatives from all the other states had not, thus preventing a quorum and delaying the start of the convention for over a week. Washington, who prided himself on being prompt, found such irresponsible delays frustrating. Franklin, who took pride in his patience, accepted the delay with grace, choosing to host a party in the meantime. On Wednesday, the delegates already in town gathered at Franklin Court for dinner. Having recently received a cask of porter from the London brewer Thomas Jordan, Franklin could think of no better time to broach it. Subsequently writing Jordan a letter of thanks, Franklin described how his guests received the cask. Its contents met with the most cordial reception and universal approbation. A hearty, dark beer, Jordan's porter was the best the delegates had ever tasted. His thank you letter captures the conviviality of the moment, but makes no mention of the conversation that occurred around the cask. Among well-educated and well-read Americans in the 18th century, literature often was a topic of polite conversation. When it came to literature, Joel Barlow's Vision of Columbus was the talk of the town that spring. Many convention delegates had subscribed to Barlow's Epic of America and looked forward to its forthcoming publication. Franklin had subscribed for 6 copies. Several months earlier, Washington had subscribed for 20 copies, but he did not pay for his subscription or receive his copies until he reached Philadelphia. He did not have time to read this 250-page poem right away, but he may have dipped into it long enough to notice how effusively Barlow praised him. Washington subscribed for so many copies of Barlow's epic partly because he knew they would make great presents. He gave some away shortly after obtaining his subscriber copies. He presented others to friends near the end of the Constitutional Convention. During his time in Philadelphia, Washington frequently dined with George Clymer, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and his wife Elizabeth. As a show of gratitude for her hospitality, Washington presented a copy of Barlow's Vision of Columbus to Elizabeth Clymer. Similarly, Washington presented another copy to Sarah Bache. She did not really need a copy of Barlow's Vision of Columbus. Had she wanted to read it, she could have read one of her father's copies. Presenting the book to Sarah Bache, Washington expressed his gratitude for her hospitality during his many visits to Franklin Court while he was in town for the Constitutional Convention. Giving her a book instead of, say, a set of silver napkin rings, Washington subtly complimented Sarah Bache, acknowledging her intellectual ability as well as her capacity as a hostess. Washington took advantage of his time in Philadelphia to renew some old acquaintances. Since visiting Mount Vernon, the painter Robert Edge Pine had finished construction on a combination home and gallery to display his paintings, the first building in the United States designed specifically to exhibit works of art. Located on the second floor, the exhibit hall was 50 feet wide and 33 feet deep with a lofty ceiling. According to one contemporary description, it was lighted from above in an elegant style. Washington spoke with Pine and enjoyed the exhibit. America, the allegorical painting Washington had so far seen only in a mezzotint reproduction, was massive, 9.5 feet across and nearly 7 feet tall. The figure of heroic virtue still looked nothing like him, though. From May 25th, the day his fellow delegates unanimously elected George Washington president of the Constitutional Convention, until it adjourned the third week of September, the business of founding a new government kept him quite busy. From his presidential chair, he attentively listened to all the debates, weighing the arguments on both sides of the question. Washington remained fairly quiet during the day-to-day proceedings, but one surviving anecdote suggests that he kept his sense of humor in the midst of heated arguments regarding the nation's new government. The issue of a standing army proved to be quite controversial. What form would it take? How large should it be? These are some of the questions the framers of the Constitution sought to answer. When one delegate moved that a standing army should be limited to 5,000 troops at any given time, Washington whispered to another delegate that they should amend the motion by providing that no foreign enemy should invade the United States at any one time with more than 3,000 troops. The business of establishing a government required intense study. Throughout the convention, Washington read everything he could get his hands on that pertained to the Constitution. He benefited from James Madison's extensive research on the subject. An abstract of the general principles of ancient and modern confederacies, a work which fills 18 pages in Jared Sparks's edition of Washington's writings, shows how beholden he was to Madison. Having prepared a detailed set of notes on the history of confederacies from ancient times to the present, Madison shared his notes with Washington, who diligently transcribed them. Omitting Madison's erudite Latin quotations and his scholarly documentation, Washington created a reader-friendly version of Madison's notes, which he could consult himself and share with other delegates. Though the proceedings of the Constitutional Convention occupied much of Washington's time in Philadelphia, he did pursue other activities in his spare moments. As he always did when he was in Philadelphia, he spent time shopping for books. Some of the books he obtained that summer came as gifts, others he purchased. All would make handsome additions to his home library and give him many hours of reading pleasure. Hector Saint-Jean de Crèvecoeur, then serving as French consul to New York, sent him a copy of the French edition of Letters from an American Farmer. Though unable to read the French text, he appreciated the gift and wrote Crèvecoeur to tell him so. Washington also acquired the English version, which he read thoroughly and recommended to others. He told one correspondent that Letters from an American Farmer will afford a great deal of profitable and amusive information respecting the private life of the Americans, as well as the progress of agriculture, manufactures, and arts in their country. If there were any faults to the book, in Washington's opinion, they involved Crèvecoeur's tendency to paint too rosy a picture. Perhaps the picture he gives, though founded in fact, is in some instances embellished with rather too flattering circumstances. Washington's interpretation of Letters of an American Farmer reflects the book's contemporary reception. The dark ending of the work, from the disturbing image of the tortured and mutilated slave to Farmer James's desperate flight from his plantation, apparently did not faze Crèvecoeur's 18th-century readers. The last week of July, Washington purchased a copy of Samuel Butler's Hudibras, a small but attractive edition illustrated by William Hogarth. This purchase, combined with references to Hudibras in Washington's letters, reveals much about his literary knowledge. Hudibras is a rollicking, mock-heroic, quasi-picaresque satire of English Protestantism, written in short rhyming couplets and filled with comic references. Since its initial publication in the mid-17th century, it had become a popular work in England and the colonies, strongly influencing early American verse. Hudibras also functioned as social capital. When Governor Alexander Spotswood came to Virginia, for example, he presented a copy of Hudibras to one of the colony's leading citizens, William Byrd II. John Park Custis, Byrd's brother-in-law, had a copy of Hudibras in his library, which came to Mount Vernon with the rest of the Custis collection. The Custis copy stood on the shelves of Washington's library for years, but he apparently never read it. His correspondence confirms that he did not read Hudibras until after he obtained a copy of his own during the Constitutional Convention. In the poem, Butler versified a proverb about things being worth only what they will fetch. "For what is worth in anything but so much money as 'twill bring?" Butler paraphrases an age-old proverb that Washington had been using before he read Hudibras. Washington's earliest known usage of it occurs in a 1767 letter. Writing to a man who wished to pay off a considerable debt by giving him land instead of cash, Washington told him he had greatly overestimated the value of the land. "This at best is only worth what it will fetch, and if it sells for half that sum, I will acknowledge myself extremely mistaken." In a place like Colonial Virginia, where land was more plentiful than hard currency, this traditional saying was especially appropriate. Though the proverb occurs elsewhere in Washington's correspondence, he does not attribute it to Hudibras until 1788, the year after he purchased his copy of the book. That year, Washington wrote a correspondent asking him to appraise another tract of land he had been offered as payment for a debt. "Butler says everything is worth what it will fetch, but in these times of scarcity, everything will not fetch what it is worth, and it is for that reason I have asked your opinion respecting the latter." After reading Hudibras, in other words, Washington could reuse a favorite saying, but instead of attributing it solely to traditional wisdom, he could attribute it to a literary source, enhancing the sophistication of his correspondence and, in a subtle way, showing off his literary knowledge. Another purchase Washington made when he was in Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention seems similarly motivated: James Thompson's lengthy philosophical poem, The Seasons. Like Hudibras, The Seasons found favor among many sophisticated early American readers. Benjamin Franklin, for one, told a friend, "I had read no poetry for several years, and almost lost the relish of it, till I met with his Seasons. That charming poet has brought more tears of pleasure into my eyes than all I ever read before. I wish it were in my power to return him any part of the joy he has given me." Thompson originally published The Seasons in the 1720s. That it had so far escaped Washington's attention indicates another gap in his literary knowledge. That he purchased an edition of it now reflects his desire to fill that gap. Beyond his financial accounts, Washington's papers make no further mention of The Seasons, but this acquisition parallels his acquisition of Hudibras. Dropping references to renowned works of English literature, far from being pretentious, was merely a part of the everyday conversation among well-to-do gentlemen in early America. Washington's purchase of both Hudibras and The Seasons reveals a crucial aspect of his intellectual life. Despite his strength of character, his presence of mind, his ability to bend men to his will, Washington remained quite self-conscious about his spotty knowledge of literature. He apparently felt uncomfortable when others alluded to works he did not know. Reading Hudibras and The Seasons, he familiarized himself with two well-known and widely respected works. Washington's behavior at the end of the Constitutional Convention is remarkably similar to his behavior at the end of the Revolutionary War. He imagined his retirement from public life and bought books to read at his leisure. On September 17th, the last day of the convention, he ordered two books, both works of fiction, a four-volume English edition of Don Quixote and Thomas Amory's two-volume novel, The Life of John Buncle. The purchase of fiction was unusual for Washington. He had not added any novels to his library since he was a young man. His acquisition of Don Quixote parallels his purchase of Hudibras and The Seasons. It, too, was a work familiar to many convention delegates, a group that included some of the best educated and well-read men in the nation. Franklin Court was not the only place in Philadelphia where Don Quixote entered the conversation. The work was so well known that friends and fellow delegates would toss off allusions to it in conversation. William Livingston, a delegate from New Jersey, was known as the Don Quixote of the Jerseys. Simply put, the imaginative world of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza was part of the everyday world of the 18th century gentleman. Whereas his acquisition of an English edition of Don Quixote reflects Washington's desire to catch up his literary knowledge and align it with that of his peers, his acquisition of John Buncle shows him deepening his literary knowledge with another pleasurable picaresque novel. Amory's Life of John Buncle was not nearly as well known as Don Quixote. Rarely did 18th century readers toss off allusions to John Buncle. With this purchase, Washington was not just catching up on his literary knowledge, he was going beyond the standard works to broaden his knowledge. John Buncle was ideal for that purpose. In the 20th century, George Saintsbury would remark, "It may be doubted whether anybody really understands the 18th century, as it was and as it might have been, until he has read John Buncle." More than any of the books Washington obtained in Philadelphia during the Constitutional Convention, John Buncle verifies his literary predilections. A modern editor calls this novel an object of interest to the connoisseur, the explorer of curious bypaths of literature, and to all who have a liking for the eccentricities of human nature when conjoined with strength and shrewdness and with candor of expression. Narrated in the first person from its hero's point of view, John Buncle begins by describing his journey through northern England, where he encounters a series of beautiful, learned women, whom he marries, Bluebeard-like, one after another. The plot itself is less important than its digressions on a variety of literary, religious, and scientific topics. Like Tristram Shandy, John Buncle is a veritable celebration of digression. William Hazlitt said that the soul of Rabelais passed into Thomas Avery when he wrote John Buncle. Charles Lamb, another one of the book's admirers, found in it an infinite fund of pleasantry, describing John Buncle as an extraordinary compound of all manner of subjects, from the depth of the ludicrous to the heights of sublime religious truth. Washington's surviving copy of John Buncle is the two-volume 1766 edition. This particular copy had originally been sold by Philadelphia bookseller John Sparhawk, whose label appears in the first volume. Both volumes are handsomely bound in sprinkled calf. But Sparhawk, or whoever bound the set, was somewhat careless. Washington did not realize the binding error until after he returned to Mount Vernon and started reading John Buncle. He might have returned the book to Sparhawk with a request to rebind it with all its parts in the proper order, but he did not. Instead, Washington devised an original way to cope with the binding error. Usually, he wrote in his books only to correct typographical errors. The binding mistake in his copy of John Buncle is an error on a greater scale. Consequently, Washington inscribed detailed instructions for himself or whoever else might be reading it. In his misbound copy, the first page of Part 2 occurs after the table of contents in the first volume. At the bottom of that page, and continuing onto the bottom of the following one, Washington wrote, "To read this work in the order it is written, the reader must begin with the first page of the second volume, read to the 225th page, then proceed from the same page in this first volume and continue to the end thereof, after which he or she is to return to the first page of the same and read to the 225th, and lastly begin at the 225th page of the second volume, read to the end, a mistake in binding having occasioned these errors. Elsewhere in his copy of this two-volume work, Washington elaborated on his reading roadmap. At the bottom of page 1 in the second volume, he wrote, "This, though called the second volume, is the beginning of the first volume and continues to be part thereof to the 225th page." At the bottom of page 224 in the second volume, he placed an asterisk next to the catchword with the instruction, "Turn to the 225th page of the first volume for the continuation of the work in its due course." At the end of Volume 1, he wrote another note. "Return to the beginning of this volume for the regular continuation of the life of John Buncle, Esquire, occasioned by a mistake in binding the work together." And at the bottom of page 224 of Volume 1, he placed an asterisk next to the catchword and a corresponding asterisk with the direction, "Turn to the 225th page of the second volume for the continuation of this work." Washington's reading instructions make his copy of John Buncle one of the most fascinating items to survive from his library. They show his mind in action. Instead of returning the volume to his Philadelphia bookseller, he found a way to fix the problem himself. The reading instructions Washington wrote inside the volume show him using his ingenuity and his determination to overcome an obstacle. They display in miniature the same skills he used on the battlefield and in politics. These reading instructions also display Washington's courtesy. His conjoined pair of pronouns, he or she, shows that he wrote these instructions not only for himself, but for anyone else who might read the book. Whoever might borrow it would not have to struggle with the out-of-order binding. The reader could simply follow Washington's directions. The instructions reveal Washington's awareness that his books would survive him. Whoever read his copy of The Life of John Buncle in the future would have George Washington as a guide. He acquired another picaresque novel around the same time he obtained Don Quixote and John Buncle, Alain René Lesage's History of Gil Blas, in Tobias Smollett's four-volume translation. Precisely how he obtained this work is a mystery. Unlike Don Quixote and John Buncle, Gil Blas is not mentioned in Washington's financial accounts. It may have been a gift. Its similarity to the other two works, combined with the fact that Washington's copy was a recent London edition, makes it likely that he obtained Gil Blas when he was in Philadelphia for the Constitutional Convention. Washington's desire to read Gil Blas parallels his desire to read Don Quixote. It, too, was a work friends and fellow patriots knew well. A few years earlier, Thomas Jefferson had linked Gil Blas and Don Quixote, calling them the best books of their class as far as I am acquainted with them. The year before the Constitutional Convention, New York bookseller Archibald Mullane promoted the sale of Gil Blas by calling it a favorite novel. Episodes from Gil Blas were part of the lingua franca of the 18th century gentleman. Washington's friends often alluded to the novel in conversation and in writing. Elbridge Gerry, a delegate from Massachusetts who would serve as U.S. Vice President under James Madison, provides a good example. Once the Constitutional Convention ended, numerous essays for and against the Constitution appeared in the press. These essays sought to sway the opinions of those attending the state ratification conventions. One newspaper contributor who wrote under the pseudonym Landholder informed readers that it was their duty to follow the Constitution. Gerry had some misgivings about the Constitution and thought it deserved further scrutiny. He found landholders' inflexibility wrong-headed and his over-reliance on the printed word misguided. He compared landholder to Dr. Sangerado in Gil Blas, who, being advised to alter his practice, as it was founded on false principles and destructive to his patients, firmly determined to pursue it because he had written a book in support of it. The episode Gary remembered from Gil Blas is fairly typical of this picaresque novel, which presents a fictional autobiography of its title hero. Gil Blas goes through a series of adventures, some exciting, others disappointing, all of which contribute to his knowledge of how the world works. Despite the book's episodic structure, it possesses a certain continuity. Time and again, the characters who befriend Gil Blas and gain his confidence ultimately reveal their greed, hypocrisy, and capacity for underhanded double-dealing. Elbridge Gerry used the character of Dr. Sangredo to critique landholders' stubborn narrow-mindedness. Other characters in Gil Blas could serve as examples to demonstrate the faults and foibles of modern man. Once he read Gil Blas, Washington himself started using characters as analogies for incidents in his own life. After the convention delegates hammered out the details of the Constitution and finished the final draft, they had copies printed to distribute throughout the nation to prepare citizens for the next phase, ratification by the individual states. Washington obtained several copies of the Constitution, one for himself and extras to pass along to friends and other influential figures. Catching up his correspondence before leaving Philadelphia, he wrote Thomas Jefferson in Paris, announcing the end of the convention and sending him a copy. Washington also sent one to Lafayette. In his cover letter to Lafayette, he called the Constitution a child of fortune to be fostered by some and buffeted by others. Washington brought additional copies with him to Mount Vernon to distribute to Virginia friends. He sent one to Patrick Henry. He could have predicted how Henry would react to the Constitution before he sent him a copy. Henry felt it put far too much power in the hands of the federal government and not nearly enough in the states. As Washington suspected, Henry proved to be one of the strongest opponents of the Constitution in Virginia. The fierce opposition Henry expressed in his thank you letter to Washington indicates the resistance the Constitution would face as it came before the state ratification conventions. Cognizant of the objections opponents would make against the Constitution, three of its staunchest defenders, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, took preemptive action. They began writing The Federalist, a newspaper essay series that contemporaries sometimes call the Publius Essays, after the pseudonym its authors chose, a pseudonym identifying them with the American public. Though written as a partisan newspaper essay series, The Federalist, of course, remains a crucial document for interpreting the intentions of the framers. Time has given it the status of constitutional law. It explains how the U.S. Constitution will work, what it will accomplish, and the pitfalls it will avoid. The Constitution, Publius assured readers, would guarantee the success of the democratic process and the American Republic, giving a voice to the people and protecting their rights. Both Hamilton and Madison sent Washington copies of some of the newspapers in which The Federalist appeared. Washington took the responsibility to disseminate The Federalist further. After Madison sent him the first seven numbers of the series, Washington forwarded them to Richmond printer John Dixon, who republished them in his weekly Virginia Gazette and Independent Chronicle. Washington continued to make sure the Publius Essays reached as many readers in Virginia as possible, sending additional numbers to Dixon as he received them from Madison. By the time the series reached its completion in 1788, eight states had ratified the Constitution. But it still faced serious opposition in both New York and Virginia, where delegations had yet to convene. To bolster support, the authors of The Federalist gathered the Publius essays together and issued a 2-volume collected edition. The first volume appeared in March, the second in May. Washington ultimately received 2 sets of The Federalist. Before the second volume appeared, he wrote a stirring appreciation of the work. Having read the entire series as the individual essays appeared, he did not need to wait for the second volume to be published before expressing his overall opinion. As the Virginia Ratification Convention approached, Washington predicted the fate of the Constitution in Virginia. "Upon the whole, I doubt whether the opposition to the Constitution will not ultimately be productive of more good than evil. It has called forth in its defense abilities, which would not perhaps have been otherwise exerted, that have thrown new lights upon the science of government. They have given the rights of man a full and fair discussion, and have explained them in so clear and forcible a manner as cannot fail to make a lasting impression upon those who read the best publications on the subject, and particularly the pieces under the signature of Publius. There will be a greater weight of abilities opposed to the system in the convention of this state than there has been in any other. But, notwithstanding the unwearied pains which have been taken, and the vigorous efforts which will be made in the convention to prevent its adoption, I have not the smallest doubt but it will obtain here." As Washington predicted, Virginia did indeed ratify the Constitution, despite Patrick Henry's best efforts to thwart its approval. New York did too. The ratification by these 2 powerful, populous, and geographically crucial states assured the acceptance of the Constitution across the United States. The visual culture reinforces the significance of the Federalist to Washington's intellectual and political life. The Lansdowne portrait, the full-length portrait of Washington that Gilbert Stuart painted during his presidency, makes The Federalist a key text in Washington's life. Stuart depicted several books in this painting, some with clearly legible titles. These books do not necessarily replicate actual books from Washington's library. Like other objects in the painting, they possess rich symbolic power. 2 volumes appear atop the table. The Journal of Congress stands upright, with The Federalist propped against it. The image suggests the ideas that The Federalist embodies provide the philosophical and ideological support necessary for Congress to operate. Together, the 2 give President Washington the power and authority to rule the nation with fairness and justice. A corner of the tablecloth is turned up to reveal additional books beneath the table. Their appearance and position reinforce the importance of books in Washington's life. Before taking the presidential oath of office, Washington had read widely and learned much from his reading, but he had no need to display his knowledge ostentatiously. He wears his erudition lightly, keeping it hidden like a set of books beneath a cloth-covered table. He does not need to show off his learning. He knows it is there. He has synthesized his reading and can now use it to govern the nation. Reading the likes of Don Quixote, Gil Blas, and John Buncle at the same time he was reading The Federalist, Washington would seem to have been engaged in 2 very different literary activities. Perhaps the 2 types of reading are not unrelated. The world of the picaresque novel is filled with all types of people, from the lowest blackguards to leaders of church and state. Gil Blas starts his adventures in a cave full of robbers who force him to live the life of a highway thief. After escaping their clutches, he encounters many other people, some of whom occupy positions of respect and authority. Gil Blas learns that highwaymen and statesmen are not so different after all. Leaders of church and state are no less liable to indulge their desire for money and power than cave-dwelling robbers. In its broadest perspective, the picaresque novel is a comment on human nature, revealing the greed, thirst for power, and need for control that are inherent aspects of the human condition. Government itself can be interpreted similarly. In Federalist No. 51, James Madison asks, "But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature?" He followed this rhetorical question with a poignant observation. "If men were angels, no government would be necessary." The picaresque novel portrays a world that is out of control, one where people grab all the money and power and control they can. The U.S. Constitution, as the Federalist clarifies, provides a way to control human nature, to guard against the abuse of power, and channel it to the common good.